A senior IRGC commander warns if Israel takes any action against Iran's nuclear sites, regime will face a more powerful response in kind. At least 9 people are killed in fresh Israeli attacks in Gaza, where the death toll is nearing 34,000. And Palestinians denounced the U.S. for vetoing a resolution that called for Palestine's full UN membership. Our top story, Iran's warned in case of any Israeli military attack on the country's nuclear sites, it'll give a response in kind to the regime's aggression. Have a listen. Ahmed Haqtalab is commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps unit responsible for safeguarding Iran's nuclear sites. He said Iran has identified all Israeli nuclear facilities and powerful Iranian missiles are ready to destroy specific targets at any moment. Haqtalab added that Iran may reconsider its nuclear doctrine and policies in case of any Israeli aggression against its nuclear facilities. He said Iran has always had the power to attack regime's nuclear bases, but has remained committed to international regulations that prohibit such attacks. Haqtalab stressed, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said before, the days of hit and run are over for Israel. He noted in case of an Israeli strike on Iran, the country's response will be powerful and destructive. And now here's a number of more known Israeli military sites that could be possible targets for Iran's armed forces in case of Israel further escalating tensions.
Negev Nuclear Research Center, Dimona. The Shimon Peres Negev Nuclear Research Center is an Israeli nuclear installation located in the Negev Desert, about 13 kilometers southeast of the city of Dimona. Israel's plutonium production and extraction facilities, along with other weapons-related infrastructure, are situated there. Ailaban is Israel's second weapons storage facility. Tactical nuclear shells and landmines are among its contents. Kfar Zakharia, Israel's suspected nuclear missile base and bomb storage facility. Nahal Sorek. This one is the equivalent of the U.S. National Weapons Laboratories. The lab handles weapons design and construction, as well as research. Yodefat is a suspected nuclear weapons assembly facility. Tirosh, reportedly one of 2 Israeli nuclear weapons storage facilities. It is speculated that Tirosh is a strategic weapons storage site, while Ailaban is a tactical weapons storage site. Rafael Factory. Rafael has been responsible for the assembly of Israel's missiles.
Spokesperson for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps rejected Israel's allegation about damage to the Dimona nuclear plant during Iran's recent punitive operation. Brigadier General Ramadan Sharif says claim is part of the regime's psychological warfare. He added that Dimona power plant was not among targets of Iran's retaliatory operation. He said regime's allegation was nothing but a big lie which was aimed at deceiving public opinion. His remarks came after Israeli media claimed at least one missile hit a building in the Dimona plant during Iran's operation. Regimes threatened to give a response to Iran's retaliatory operation, which hit its military bases. Iran's vowed to respond in kind to any Israeli attack on its nuclear sites. Explosions heard in the Iranian city of Isfahan earlier Friday were due to activation of air defenses in the central city. That, according to a senior army figure in Isfahan, 2nd Brigadier General Siavash Mihandus says air defenses in Isfahan fired at suspicious objects. He said no damage was caused, and earlier informed sources said Iran's air defenses shot down 3 quadcopters over Isfahan. They said no incident occurred in the country's military or nuclear sites. The International Atomic Energy Agency also confirmed there has been no damage to Iran's nuclear facilities. According to Iran's Civil Aviation Organization, all airports throughout the country have been brought back to normal functioning after flights were temporarily suspended. Reports of explosions come amid Israel's threats that it will respond to Iran's punitive strike launched on the regime's targets over the weekend. The strike was in retaliation for Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria on the 1st of April. Antoine Asadi, an academic and political analyst, joined us earlier and spoke about the blast in Isfahan and gave us some context on it.
We know that the Israelis had reportedly warned Biden administration earlier on Thursday that they will have kind of attack or strike on Iran in the next 24 or 48 hours. Whether the events this morning are the response of Israelis have been talking about is too early to say, I think, but at all events, as you said, the situation currently speaking looks quite calm, no sign of explosion or injury, but quite opposite to what we see in the as a reality on the ground is the media reports by the Israelis and their Western allies in the mainstream Western media that says these mini quadcopters have targeted important places and caused destruction. Well, it comes all from the disastrous climatic situation in which the Israelis are located. They are actually exhausted by failure in war in Gaza over 6 months of, disastrous failed attempt to defeat Hamas. While on the other hand, they did not expect such a retaliatory attack from Iran taking place at this scale. So Iran also said that there is this sort of idea that there is no interest in further escalation. But at the time being, we know that the previous attack was limited in scale, while the next is expected to be further extended.
And now, over 6 months on, the Israeli army continues its campaign of death and destruction in Gaza, where more people are falling victim to unrelenting attacks. At least 9 people were killed and several injured in fresh attacks throughout the besieged enclave. There are also reports of 15 people missing under rubble. Now, attacks hit 2 different areas of Gaza City, as well as a Nusayrat refugee camp in the center of the strip. Death toll from Israel's campaign of genocide in Gaza has now risen to nearly 34,000 since early October. Most of the victims have been women and children, and thousands of Palestinians are still unaccounted for and presumed buried under rubble. Israeli war has also caused worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where almost the entire population is facing hunger. To Abu Musabe joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir el-Balah with an update.
The last night was brutal and vehement for the Palestinian civilians across all areas of Gaza Strip, basically Gaza City, whereas the Israeli warplanes continued decimating Gaza City with more relentless airstrikes. And the Ashad refugee camp, a Palestinian residential building, was completely destroyed after the Israeli warplanes carried out several airstrikes. At least 4 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over the attack, while dozens were injured. And in the meantime, Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood also was hit relentlessly after the Israeli occupation forces launched several airstrikes. Another residential building actually was destroyed. At least 4 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed as well. In the meantime, when it comes to Asabra neighborhood, the headquarters of the Gaza Community College was completely flattened to the ground due to the relentless and the fierce Israeli airstrikes hitting that area. While when it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, basically Jabal refugee camp, the Israeli warplanes continued and resumed their airstrikes against the eastern part of Jabal refugee camp. Another residential building was destroyed and leveled to the ground as well in the Tal al-Za'atar neighborhood, which is located in the eastern part of Jabal refugee camp. In the meantime, when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip here in Deir el-Balah city and Al-Maghazi and Al-Burej refugee camp, they were under heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery shelling that was maintained against those areas all the night.
The Palestinian government and Hamas condemned the United States for blocking Palestine's bid for full UN membership. The resistance movement Hamas denounced the U.S. for using its veto power to block the bid. Hamas said U.S. move is in line with its continued support for Israel, which the movement said has made the regime more isolated internationally. The Palestinian Authority also denounced the veto as unfair, unethical, and unjustifiable. It emphasized the U.S. veto defies the will of the international community. Palestine's UN envoy also said UN membership is a necessary step to reverse the injustice inflicted upon Palestinians for decades.
The fact that this resolution did not pass will not break our will. And it will not defeat our determination. We will not stop in our effort. The state of Palestine is inevitable. It is real.
Mansour added the Palestinians will continue efforts to become a full UN member. The UN Security Council held a vote on Palestine's membership on Thursday. Britain and Switzerland abstained, while 12 other council members voted yes. This was the second Palestinian attempt for full UN membership. Palestine is currently a non-member observer state. Its full membership has to be approved by the Security Council and at least two-thirds of the General Assembly. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has released footage of its Thursday operation targeting the headquarters of the Israeli Army's Brigade 91 at the Branit Barracks. The movement says it used one of its Burkan missiles, which has a heavy warhead, to hit the regime's barracks. This was one of 11 anti-Israeli operations carried out by Hezbollah on Thursday. The movement has conducted several major attacks on Israeli military sites in recent days. On Wednesday, a missile and drone operation left at least 19 Israeli soldiers injured in a new reconnaissance command center in Arab al-Aramsha. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel's changed a long-standing equation of the regime's hit-and-run strategy.
The operation, when it comes to its importance, it is that it established the equation of responding to the Israeli enemy at the time where the enemy and its partners were striving to establish the equation of invading or attacking in the Arab world and elsewhere. The Israeli enemy, for tens of years, got used to striking Arab countries, countries of Muslims, and not to receive any retaliation. This happened. It happened in Iraq, it happened in Sudan, it happened in various Arab countries. The Israeli enemy would strike targets for tens of years, and no one would dare retaliate militarily. Most of the time, sometimes there would be a complaint to the UN or to the Security Council. So establishing the equation of a strong military response, this is something very important at the time where the enemy wants to preserve the equation of being allowed to attack, whereby all of the Islamic Ummah, all the countries in the Arab world and elsewhere would be open for attack for the Israeli enemy, whereby they could do anything they want without receiving any retaliation. Also establishing the rules of engagement. If they attack, there will be a strong response and a decisive response, and their aggression will not go unanswered. This is something very important. after the enemies.
Addressing a Yemeni people in a televised address, Abdelmalek al-Houthi hailed Iran's response to Israeli attack on its embassy in Damascus. He said Israel and its Western allies tried to downplay the significance of the operation after failing to prevent Iran's response. Al-Houthi, without naming a specific country, condemned some Arab states for protecting Israel during that operation. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Yemeni leader said his country will continue its operations in the Red and Arabian Seas until a total ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. After a years-long investigation by New York prosecutors, Donald Trump is facing his first criminal trial in Manhattan, New York. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A defiant Donald Trump continued to attack the prosecutor, judge and a key witness in the New York hush money criminal trial against him, a signal that the former president will continue to embrace bombast as jury selection in the case begins. Donald Trump described what will be the first criminal trial against the former US president as a communist show trial during a rally in Schnecksville, Pennsylvania, on Saturday, 13th of April. He also described his indictment as a badge of honor and cast himself as a martyr for his supporters. He claimed, "I'm proud to do it for you." Donald Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection to a $130,000 payment he made in 2016 to Stormy Daniels, a film actress. The charges were filed last year by Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney. Despite his legal travails, Donald Trump is the almost certain Republican presidential nominee for next November's presidential election. Polling between Trump and Joe Biden is close, with Donald Trump regularly showing a narrow lead in head-to-head surveys and performing strongly in various swing states. After repeated attacks, Judge Juan Merchan, who is overseeing the hush money trial, issued a gag order prohibiting Donald Trump from speaking about witnesses, jurors, lawyers, court staff, and their family members, and also members of the families of the judge himself, Juan Merchan, and the Manhattan prosecutor, Alvin Bragg. The order does not prevent Trump from attacking Judge Juan Merchan or Alvin Bragg directly. Trump appeared willing to test the boundaries of that gag order as late as Saturday, 13th of April, tweeting about Michael Cohen, his former lawyer who facilitated the payments to Stormy Daniels. Michael Cohen paid Stormy Daniels through a shell company and then was repaid a total of $420,000 by Donald Trump over the course of 2017. Trump Organization officials falsely listed the payments as legal expenses, even though Michael Cohen had no legal retainer with Donald Trump or the Trump Organization. He wrote in a post on his Truth Social platform, "Has Mark Pomerantz been prosecuted for his terrible acts in and out of the district attorney's office? Has disgraced attorney and felon Michael Cohen been prosecuted for lying? Only Trump people get prosecuted by this judge and these thugs. A dark day for our country." Donald Trump issued a series of other posts on his Truth Social platform on Saturday, 13th of April, seeking to undermine the credibility of the trial by attacking District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat, and also Judge Juan Merchan. He posted, "Why didn't the Manhattan District Attorney bring this ridiculous case 7 years ago? Because they're corrupt and wanted to use it for purposes of election interference against crooked Joe Biden's political opponent." Alvin Bragg was elected Manhattan District Attorney in 2021. Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance, started investigating Donald Trump in 2019, but was more interested in bringing charges based on Trump's falsification of business records. Alvin Bragg reversed on that strategy when he took office and chose to move ahead on the hush money case. Bragg's approach angered two prosecutors, Mark Pomerantz and Kerry Dunn, who resigned in 2022 over how Alvin Bragg was handling the investigation. Donald Trump also sought to attach the case to Joe Biden, who has no jurisdiction over the Manhattan District Attorney's office. The trial is far from a slam dunk for Alvin Bragg. Falsifying business records is a misdemeanor in New York State and is only elevated to a felony if there is an intent to commit another crime. Alvin Bragg has said Donald Trump intended to violate campaign finance and tax laws with his scheme, a somewhat novel legal theory. Trump faces three other criminal cases, but has successfully delayed all of them. That has forced the New York case and the paper crimes at the heart of it to take on increased importance, since it may be the only case to go to trial before the 2024 presidential election. Alvin Bragg has sought to reframe the case not just as a matter of falsifying business records, but a matter of election interference, saying Trump was trying to conceal critical information from voters on the eve of the 2016 presidential election. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. After a years-long investigation by New York prosecutors, Donald Trump is facing his first criminal trial in Manhattan, New York. Trump is charged with covering up a $130,000 payment to a movie star, Stormy Daniels, and falsifying business records. Trump allegedly had his former fixer, Michael Cohen, pay Stormy Daniels, while Trump reimbursed Cohen in 2017 and reported the reimbursement as legal fees. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged Trump with 34 counts of falsifying business records. Prosecutors charged that Donald Trump fudged his business records to cover up criminal activity, including trying to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election. The trial will kick off with jury selection and is expected to last about 6 weeks. On 26th of October 2016, just 11 days before Election Day, Michael Cohen initiated a $130,000 payment to actress Stormy Daniels. While prosecutors have identified two other hush money payments to people who said they had stories about Donald Trump, one of the former Trump Tower doormen and another, Karen McDougal, a former model, the actual charges for the case stem just from Stormy Daniels' payments. That's because the other hush money payments were made by American Media, the parent company of the tabloid National Enquirer. Leaders of the company, especially the then chief executive officer David Pecker, were close allies of Donald Trump and told him early in the campaign that they would help him with any scandalous stories that might come out about him. But Donald Trump paid Stormy Daniels himself, albeit through his fixer Michael Cohen. Each of the 34 counts of falsifying business records represents a document that prosecutors said included hush money payments, masked as legal fees to Michael Cohen. The jury will decide whether Donald Trump hid the payments to Stormy Daniels to cover up criminal activity, what prosecutors refer to as concealed crimes. While the concealed crimes are not explicitly outlined in the indictment of Trump's charges, the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg said the payment had violated New York's election laws, which makes it a crime to conspire to promote a candidacy by unlawful means. Alvin Bragg said in April of 2023, when the charges were announced, "That is why Donald Trump made false statements about his payments to Michael Cohen. He could not simply say that the payments were reimbursements for Cohen's payments to Stormy Daniels. To do so, to make that true statement, would have been to admit to a crime." Donald Trump denies Stormy Daniels' story, though he admits to making the payment to Stormy Daniels, saying in 2018 that the agreement was used to stop the false and extortionist accusations made by her about an affair. Alvin Bragg said his office had prosecuted hundreds of concealed crimes through charges of falsifying business records.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The success of Iran's retaliatory operation True Promise against the Israeli regime has changed the equations in the region. On the one hand, it has shattered the invincibility of not only the Israeli regime, but its backers, like the U.S., when it comes to defense capabilities. And on the other hand, it has shown that Iran's military might is a force to be reckoned with. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this operation has impacted the West Asia region and whether it will impact major crises like the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war, or for it to lead for the departure of the U.S. forces, something that Iran and the resistance groups in the region want. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Sarah Flanders, International Action Center, joins us from New York. Also joining us, Vincent James, podcaster and founder of Daily Veracity, joins us from L.A. Thank you, and welcome to you both. And Vincent James, I'll start with you. Operation True Promise. I'm sure you're familiar with that. It was a successful retaliatory operation, and one of the things that it did was it broke Israel's defense capabilities. And you had 10 countries that were involved trying to basically shoot down the salvo of drones and missiles that were coming down into the occupied Palestine. Do you see that as being a defeat when it comes to the defensive action that failed, not only on the part of Israel, but also for the other countries that tried to prevent these missiles and drones from coming down?
Yeah, I think, well, number one, if we're looking at like the Iron Dome, for instance, I don't think that the Iron Dome is foolproof. I think that a lot of it is almost, I think it's boosted up a bit so that other countries don't get the idea that, you know, they should send missiles into Israel. I think that right now, in terms of what's happened since October 7th, I think Israel and the powers that be here in America, the Israel lobby is the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., and it's not even close. I think that they've really overplayed their hand, and I think that they just don't care anymore. And they're going to try to achieve the goals that they've had for a very long time by any means necessary now, right? The goal of, for instance, October 7th, they use this as a pretext to kill off Palestinians. I mean, quite frankly, to commit a genocide, quite frankly. and expand the Israeli state. And then in addition to that, if we're looking at, you know, what's going on with Iran, every single time there's a terrorist attack that happens, it's always blamed on Iranian proxies, right? The reason being is because Iran is their final boss, and it's been their the final boss for a while. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, the U.S. is going to stay out of this war and Israel's by themselves, but something's going to happen. They're going to push and push and push and push and push until the U.S. basically has no choice but to enter into this conflict in some way, shape, or form.
Okay, so you're saying you're talking about Israel that's going to keep pushing and pushing. Is that what you mean?
Right, yeah, 100%.
Okay, well, that is something I'd like to address to you, Sarah Flounders, because to use the words of the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, quote, the Zionist regime's defeat was an intelligence, security, and military one, but it was a strategic setback above all. I think what our guest there talks about in that context would be the old order, because it doesn't seem like Israel can, and when it wants to, and if it desires to at this point, because firsthand it has received the military, it has felt the military might of the Islamic Republic. What do you think?
Well, it is a huge strategic setback, and a setback for Israel, a setback for U.S. imperialism. This war couldn't go on 1 minute without the billions and billions of dollars that have been provided year in, year out, 75 years, because Israel, for U.S. imperialism, was their guarantee, their strategic ally in the entire region, their war in the entire region, and their destabilizing engine for the whole region. And that is what they are losing. Israel cannot, will not really survive with the standing that it had, which was completely made cover and possible by the U.S. Those days are gone in terms of the whole world, and also in terms of the very significant Iranian response to this criminal attack on Iran, on an Iranian consulate, and the world stood by and did nothing. So Iran responded, as they had every right to do. Now Israel it's been exposed that it no longer has the ability to protect itself, even from an announced launch, an attack that was days in the making, where every message was sent. Nevertheless, they continued in their lawlessness. So now they face a quandary, because in front of the whole world, it's been shown their vulnerability, their failure, and it's important. It's a big failure for the U.S. Their strategic ally is no more.
Sure. Vincent James, I'd like to challenge you on this idea about how they want to keep pressing and pressing. I mean, what are they going to keep pressing against is my question to you. I'm looking here, for example, of the description of these advanced hypersonic missiles that Iran has. Basically, looking at the description that I see here, the range 1,400 kilometers, two-stage solid fuel, pinpoint accuracy, and these were the types, Fatah 1 and 2, that most likely the Fatah 2, which is a more advanced version, made it to that Nevatim airbase. I believe anywhere from 7 to 8 of them hit the intended target, and that was in a restrained mode in terms of the measured retaliatory response that Iran had. Isn't that enough for Israel to double think whether it wants to move ahead, and more so, its backer, the U.S., to also analyze the situation, which I believe the last that we know, the U.S. says, if you do go ahead with a retaliatory attack, you're on your own.
Yeah, they say that. And you know, when we talk about thinking, I don't know if we can talk about thinking or double thinking when it comes to bloodthirsty, evil, crazy, insane people. Like, I just saw some tweet just recently. Netanyahu unveils plan to construct settlements in Gaza backed by a staggering investment of $5 billion. You have Jared Kushner talking about how Gaza beachfront properties are very valuable. Now, I mean, this has been their goal for a long time, and they're going to stop at nothing. Israel, the Israeli state, the Zionist regime is going to stop at nothing to achieve their goals. You know, they have the Samson option. This is something that was invented by Israel. And we have here in America, you have people like Mark Levin, you have people like Ben Shapiro talking about how if America doesn't get involved in these wars, then we're going to have to resort to using nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons, by the way, that they achieved after the assassination of JFK, after the Apollo affair, where they stole 600 pounds of highly enriched uranium from the U.S. through an American company owned by an American Jew. And the other guest talked about billions of dollars. It's really like $1 trillion that we've given Israel since the early 2000s, if you consider military aid, monetary aid, military equipment, and the interest that they make off of the money that we give them. And then I really, a lot of people talk about how Israel is an ally. Honestly, they've acted more like an enemy to the U.S. And this is something, speaking to Americans, Israel has acted more of an enemy to the U.S. than an ally. Israeli actions have put the lives of Americans in danger for a very long time, decade after decade after decade. We can go back to the invasion of Lebanon that we told them not to do, and then they did it anyway. Then we had to send in American Marines as a peacekeeping force, and then you had the Beirut barracks bombing that killed 241 Americans. You can look at the USS Liberty. Uh-huh. You can look at, you know, all of the Levon affair, all of these different actions by the Israeli state to achieve their goal to the detriment of American citizens and the American military. And I think that they're going to stop at nothing to achieve their goals. And one more thing on the Iron Dome. Again, the Iron Dome, I think the world has seen, is not foolproof. It's not foolproof. And technology, you know, we paid for that. The American taxpayers paid for the Iron Dome. And this is technology that they won't even hand over to the U.S. still to this day. And it's just, you know, I don't know that we can talk about thinking when it comes to bloodthirsty, evil, evil, evil criminals.
Yeah, and it's not just the Iron Dome. Actually, there are two other defense systems, like David Sling, right, I believe, and the Arrow, along with the Iron Dome, which is multi-layered, but yet those hypersonic missiles, as an example, made it through. You know, this thing with the U.S. Ironclad support that we're looking at, Sarah Flounders, even the U.S. has come out and said, and this is what the U.S. President Joe Biden said, Israelis are facing major, possibly generational damage to their reputation. Of course, the Israeli genocidal war that's backed by the U.S. Has a lot to do with that. But how badly is Israel doing? I mean, we know that its image is not, obviously, it's tarnished. World standing, not doing well. Its economy is not doing well. You're having migration out of the occupied Palestine of Israelis there. I think since October 7th, we're looking at about 700,000. And then the local population there on occupied land they're coming out on protest almost every day. What type of condition is the Israeli regime in right now?
Well, the Zionist regime is in a totally untenable, unwinnable situation. And this has been proven by the resistance in Gaza, where they have failed to reach any of their aims. And it's also been shown by the actions in Yemen, which has really put a block on shipping internationally, especially to Israeli ports. Very important. And the U.S. seems powerless to stop that. So while the Zionists claim they'll stop at nothing, the fact is they are being stopped. And we should know that U.S. government will always have plausible denial. They're not responsible. But in truth, in fact, I believe the U.S. government is an enemy of the world. To say Israel is an enemy of the U.S., yeah, they're an enemy of working people in the U.S. and around the world. But the U.S. government is responsible, and U.S. corporate power is responsible for this policy of endless, endless profit and war on the whole world, not only on the people of the Arab world, the whole world, whether you look at China or Russia, whether you look at NATO. The U.S. government and corporate power is the number one enemy, and they operate through different agents. They have been targeting Iran since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, because Iran took back its own agency, its own oil, control of its own resources. That made them an enemy of U.S. corporate power, and that's what's going on today. They want to use Israel, yes. They want to use Zionism, a colonial apartheid ideology. Yes, they want to use people of every possible right. country. That's true. But where does it flow from? It flows from Wall Street, from corporate power in the U.S. It profits from all of these wars again and again. And the fact is, technology has moved on. It's moved on past the Iron Dome. It's moved on past all kinds of huge aircraft carriers that can't be refitted and rearmed in the face even of Ansarallah drones to them. So there's a lot that is happening in technology, but the big thing that's happening is a resistance that refuses to accept the old colonial order. That's what has changed, and it is dramatic. We should really salute it, right. be with it every step, and Iran defending itself has inspired people around the world.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, this resistance that our guests are just talking about, Vincent James, I can't help but to get your thoughts on the axis of resistance that comprises of countries and resistance groups. We could talk about Hezbollah, the Islamic State, the Islamic resistance in Iraq, also Yemen, as our guests there mentioned. And given the fact that these groups, of which the Islamic resistance in Iraq is comprised of over 62, it's an umbrella group, over 62 resistance groups, when you put them all together, you know, these are all groups that Iran and them are aligned. When you take a look at the way that they're engaged, a couple of them especially, like Hezbollah, with the Israeli regime, shouldn't Israel and the U.S. take that into account and look at the calculus, given the fact that now this operation by Iran has proven what it can do, and maybe these groups can also have access to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is one of the reasons why they've had such a big problem with Syria. You know, Syria was another country on there that was a target for the global American empire, for the Zionist regime, another target to destabilize, to conduct some sort of CIA color revolution regime change in. And it's because of Russia's involvement there that they have a little bit of an issue, right? There was a clandestine program that I think Barack Obama initiated during his presidency that was ended in 2017 to arm Syrian rebels against Bashar al-Assad. And so this is, I would say that America, the global American empire, if you will, has shrunken. It's become weaker over time. And it's because of these different players or the threat of these different players getting involved that maybe they have to approach things differently. Maybe they have to double think, as you said. But again, you know, if you look at the history, if you look at Israel, if you look at the Israeli government, I don't think that they care. I don't think that they care. They're going to try to pull the U.S. deeper and deeper into this conflict and the other conflicts. They're going to try to get the U.S. through AIPAC, through the Israel lobby, through WNAP, through the Jewish lobby in America, through the Jewish subversion that has been around in America after World War II, infiltrated the university, spread through there, infiltrated every single institution in American life. I think that they're going to. They don't care. They don't care what happens to their their supposed allies. I think that they're going to try. They're going to fail, but they're going to try. They're going to try, and they're going to stop at nothing.
That approach, Sarah Flounders, is going to decimate an already decimated economy. There's no doubt about that. Number two, you having, as I mentioned before, the migration out of the occupied land. And these are especially for dual citizens. And they're going to continue leaving in droves if our guess scenario comes true. But what are your thoughts when it comes to the Israeli regime as a whole, Sarah Flounders? A guest once said, you know, it's not about the military. It's not about anything but, like, even the boycott campaign. It's about how Israel, like South Africa, that was finally that apartheid regime ended. It's about the delegitimization of Israel around the world. That's what's going to put an end to this regime. Do you think that it has approached that point?
It's absolutely approached that point. Really, what the U.S. fears right now is that they are standing alone with a complete pariah state that is hated, that is exposed, that its crimes, everyone has seen just how horrendous and terrible they are. It is a regime built on settler colonialism, and that day has absolutely passed. And the economy of Israel, of course, is in more than shambles. It's being propped up, yeah, by lots of U.S. money and other Western EU money, but that's also, it's a sinking investment, and everyone can see that. In terms of, it's a settler state, so there are a large portion of Israelis who have dual citizenship, and they are headed back to the countries they came from in droves. They don't want to raise the most dangerous place to be Jewish in the world today is in Israel. Why stay? They're leaving in large numbers. The economy, not only are the schools shut down, or not only are the ports shut down, but most industries are shut down. And the corporations around the world that supplied equipment and investment and technology to Israel are finding it's no longer a good investment because there's so many sit-ins, walkouts, takeovers happening here in the U.S. and Britain, throughout Europe, demanding that these corporations disinvest. All of this is being felt in Israel, and they can't sustain that kind of loss anymore. So I think I don't know how many days, how long, how many years, but the settler colonial mentality that Zionism is based on, that they tried to rally a whole group of people around, those days are past. In terms of their own population, you look at these demonstrations, the hold of the population for Zionism is crumbling under their feet. And that's a big loss, too, because they're a small population within, surrounded by an Arab world, and that can't continue long at all. So I do think it's the resistance that is the one thing that has changed that, but also there is a sharing of technology. There is, I want to say, by the way, that Iran is not interested in war. They want peace, development, resources. They want exchange with the world.
That's a good
point. And that's true for every one of these countries. They're not for continuing a war. They are for defending themselves and standing up to a colonial aggression coming from the U.S. and coming from Israel.
That is something that Iran has said, Vincent James. Of course, who's going to, on the American side or the Israeli regime side, going to listen to that? That's probably something they don't want to hear. But that is something that Iran has said. The way that this operation was carried out, this retaliatory operation, speaks volumes within that context. Why do you think the U.S. is not, or the Israeli regime, interested in that type of approach, which Iran has stated now in the past days, when it comes to the operation that it executed?
Well, the U.S. isn't interested in peace with many Arab countries for the simple reason that Israel has completely controlled and occupied our government through lobbies, through infiltration, and other means. And when it comes to the retaliatory strike, again, you know, you look at how Iran retaliated, right? We were talking about the attack on the consulate. it's interesting that all of the American news media will say, well, Israel has a right to defend itself. And what does that look like? Well, that looks like massacring 25, 30,000 people that are mostly women and children, and then taking their homes and taking their land and giving it to Jared Kushner and other like U.S. Billionaire, millionaire Jews. Iran retaliated for the attack on the consulate, and there were no civilian victims. This is, again, you go back to the CIA, the color revolution, the regime change with Mossadegh, and again, this is the final boss. I just want to get this out to Americans here. Israel is no ally of ours. They have acted more like an enemy than an ally forever. And this is something that I think a lot of people are waking up to, thanks to Twitter, thanks to Rumble, sure, thanks to some of these other free speech platforms, thanks to your platform. I think a lot of people are waking up to this, and this adds to the fact that our other guest was talking about, that Israel is basically ending up alone in a lot of this. And it's kind of a dangerous place to be.
Right, indeed. Last question here, Sarah Flounders, quickly if you can. What happened in San Francisco was quite incredible, wasn't it? With that pro-Palestine protest that shut down the Golden Gate. I mean, at this point, when you go to the website of the organizers, they're not just a U.S. movement, they're a worldwide movement. What does that say about what Israel is doing with the U.S. in their genocidal war and the impact that's had?
This is a worldwide movement, and it is being felt right here in the U.S. with bridge shutdowns, highway shutdowns. Right here in New York, there's a shutdown of three different universities going on. Monday, shutdown of one road after another. It's really incredible. In Chicago, the airport, I can't even remember how many shutdowns are going on. But I do want to close by saying that the U.S. has used Israel against the Arab people, the people of the entire Middle East,
sure,
in the same way that they've used Taiwan against China.
Indeed.
In the same way that they've used Ukraine against Russia. They
thank you for
prop
that.
Up a state for their own
thank you for
corporate
that.
Benefit right here.
Thank
and it
you.
Is using and trying to destroy an
thanks.
Entire people for their profit.
Sorry, Sarah Flounders, fresh out of time, International Action Center. Vincent James, thank you. Podcaster and founder, Daily Veracity from L.A. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdaa al-risala.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the pure direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the 10th divinely appointed successor. He was the 10th divinely appointed imam. He was the 10th divinely appointed trustee to the final Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. A great number of Muslims believed in the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they found it obligatory upon them to follow and obey Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. A vast amount of legal dues and monies that must be given to the Imam were carried to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, as he was the financial epicenter of the Shia. And it was partly due to this financial leadership of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam that governmental investigators and policemen reported in detail to the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil. And so al-Mutawakkil Abbasi was the most bitter enemy of not only the Alawis and the followers of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, but he was a bitter enemy of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam himself. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabihit tuja wa a'lamit tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. In this conversation and in this dialogue of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the 10th Divinely Appointed Imam alayhi salam, he spoke about this concept of an individual being tried, an individual put under trial by the Almighty Allah. Now, we had said in one of our programs that the reason that Allah puts human beings through trials is so that they can prove themselves, right? So, for example, you know, in another one of our programs, we talked about how when you believe in something, you act upon it. And so this trial is kind of like this transition between belief and action, right? So, for example, we all, you know, believe that, for example, that honesty and being truthful is a good thing, it is a virtue, it is something that a Muslim must do. And so how do you act upon it? Well, sometimes there comes a position or there comes a condition or a situation in which it is, you know, I guess convenient or easier for us to not say the truth. This here is a trial. And in this trial, will we speak the truth despite it being a little bit uncomfortable or it perhaps, you know, causing some kind of superficial material harm to us? You know, or will we lie and try to avoid, you know, these kind of negative consequences of telling the truth in that situation? Now, what does this trial do? This trial, well, either will show us, are we individuals who will stick to what we believe in, or are we individuals who will run away from what we believe in? And so this is how a trial, you know, on behalf of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what it does is it differentiates between those that are good and those that are evil, those who believe in what they say or those who don't believe in what they say. And so here Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, speaking about this, he brings up a verse of the Holy Quran. He says, "It is Allah who created death and life, that Allah may try you to see which of you is best in deeds." This is Dialogue. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.